It's been 50 years this month since tens of thousands of Americans went to Washington, D.C. to protest the Vietnam War. At the time, it was the largest anti-war gathering ever. The protests didn't end there. How did the outcry against the war affect families and communities across the nation? And what did members of the military think about it all? We're discussing the people who protested the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you that technology for your home is smarter than ever. New devices and apps can simplify tasks, make better use of resources, and transform the way we live. Learn how to update your home with smart technologies at Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's free smart home class on October 25th. Learn more and register at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
People singing, marching, burning draft cards, or returning them to the Pentagon. Flowers placed in the barrels of guns. Sometimes more sinister activities took place. At the end of it all, did it change anything? Did the protests influence decisions in Washington about the draft or sending American soldiers to Vietnam? Here to talk about their own experiences in the war and protesting the war are three Alaskans. Longtime journalist, editor, and columnist Michael Carey is here with us. Hello, Michael.
Hi there.
Also in the studio is John Spitzberg. John is a veteran and a member of the international organization Veterans for Peace. Welcome, John.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And also is in the studio is Bill Barty. Bill is also a veteran and a protester. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Mm-hmm. You also can join us, Alaskans, with your thoughts, with your comments. Were you a Vietnam War protester or a counter-protester? Are you a veteran? What specifically did you object to if you were a protester? Do you protest present conflicts that are the military, the U.S. military is involved in? You can call us 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. Michael, this kind of was your idea. You proposed it to me during this whole Vietnam documentary series that's going on, the Ken Burns, Lynn Novick documentary on the Vietnam War, exhaustive 18-hour look at this entire conflict. Start us off. You just saw an exhibit on protests in Vancouver.
Yes, that's correct.
Tell us about that.
Yes, I recently was in Vancouver, and I went to the Vancouver City Museum, which is close to downtown, and they had a history of demonstrations in Vancouver. And a whole exhibit on it with panels of photographs. They had audio of people at these demonstrations. And this is a wonderful exhibit, no matter what your politics. There have been so many demonstrations in Vancouver over the years that you begin to think the impulse to demonstrate is genetic, which, of course, we know isn't true. The early demos were typically about wages and hours, working conditions. This would be, say, circa 1920. But from there, the exhibit told visitors about free speech demos, immigration demos, free trade demos, taxation, animal rights, environmental rights, fishermen's rights, human rights in China and other countries, the rights to bicycle path lanes. Then there was the demo protest when Guns N' Roses failed to show up, which led to a riot, which started as a demonstration. This was a concert that was canceled. And so this falls into the category, I believe it was Patrick Henry, who said, "Give me rock and roll or give me death." My favorite of these protests was the peeler.
Is that what he said?
Yeah. My favorite was the so-called peeler protest in Vancouver. Strippers demanding higher wages. The exhibit had a photo of several lovely young women carrying signs that said, "If we don't win, you'll see no skin." But, yes, about Vietnam, I think it's pretty well established the anti-war movement had three roots: the civil rights movement, the anti-nuclear weapons movement, and the free speech movement. And they started, importantly, on several campuses, Berkeley, Michigan, and Wisconsin. I just want to read one thing to you, and then I promise I won't monopolize the show. This will give you a sense of Todd Gitlin was an activist himself. He was a scholar. He's at Columbia now. He talked about the peace movement. He said, "What was this movement? It eludes simple definition. Movements like clouds don't have sharp edges." That's a lovely phrase. "Movements like clouds don't have sharp edges. This is one reason why journalists have a hard time getting a grip on them. The anti-war movement was far more than the alphabet soup of organizations that tried to lead it and direct it. It's not a network of celebrities. It was a movement, a social force, a work in progress, an ensemble, confusing, contentious, irregular, raucous, immense. The millions who passed through the anti-war movement, and there were millions, were as various as America itself." And that's wonderful. And then right there, Todd Gitlin's getting close to Walt Whitman. So I'm happy about that.
Well, before I move on to John and Bill, Michael, tell me about how and when you first got involved with protesting. And were you a reporter at the time?
No, I was a college student.
Okay.
In about 1962, Vietnam went from the back pages of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, where I grew up, to the front page. And there were protests, many of them led by Buddhists, against the Diem government, which eventually led to the overthrow of the government. And from there, when I went to college in the spring of, or in the fall of 1963, Vietnam was in the paper all the time. And soon there became teach-ins, which I attended, and marches I attended, but I can tell you about those later.
All right. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We are discussing protesting the Vietnam War, what that meant, how it affected families and members of the military. And we have three guests in the studio today. Two of them are veterans. Michael Carey is a journalist and former war protester, and maybe general rabble-rouser all around. Also in the studio, John Spitzberg, a veteran and member of Veterans for Peace. And Bill Barty is also a Vietnam veteran. And are you a member of Veterans for Peace, Bill?
I am.
Yes. Okay. So you can join us too. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. If you were a Vietnam War protester, if you're a current war protester, if you objected to the protests, give us a call. 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. John, when you and I talked, you told me that you were in the service from 1958 to 1972.
Correct.
And were you conflicted while you were still active duty, or was it after you left the service that you decided to speak out about against the U.S. involvement in Vietnam?
I think I come to this in a little bit different manner. In the time that I was in the military, I never went to Vietnam as a combatant. I was not in Vietnam during the war. I lived in Vietnam after the war for about 3 years. But in answer to your question is, how did I get into this? I got into this through the labor movement. I'll explain. I was living in Chicago. And I was a chief steward of a SEIU, Service Employees International Union, leading a strike. And I was out at about 5 in the morning with my colleagues, and a group of people, young folks, came walking in with Dunkin' Donuts and coffee, singing Solidarity Forever, and they were called the IWW, the Wobblies. And I fell in love with the Wobblies. And the Wobblies, if you know anything about the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies have always been in protest of workers fighting workers anywhere in the world. And I became friends with a fellow who spent time in prison because he refused to go to war against another worker in World War I. Fred Thompson was his name. And it was through the notion that workers need to be together, and that in Vietnam and in Cambodia and in Laos and et cetera, the people who are doing the fighting and getting killed are people who are workers. And so the notion of protest for me was born as a Wobbly. I've been a Wob, a dues-paying Wob now for 45 years. I'll be 80 next birthday. So bottom line, that's how I got into it, because I was raised in Washington, D.C., with two parents who were government slaves working for the United States government. And my dad had been in World War II in the European theater, but he had no sense of what I'm talking about. Mm. And my mom, no sense of it either. And while I was on active duty, I spent 3 years Army and then 2 years in the reserve, then 4 years Air Force, then the rest of the time in Guard and Reserve, and sometimes I go active, et cetera, for short periods of time. I didn't have that a real bottom line sense, although I did try to start a union when I was in the Army, because they tried to put some of us into a grease pit, and so I called for a strike, and the threat was I was going to be court-martialed for treason. Never happened, of course. But so that's how I got into the protest mm-hmm. movement. And then little by little, I recognized that this whole domino theory that was the reason given that we needed to be in Vietnam, because if we lost Vietnam, all of Southeast Asia would collapse into communism. Do you remember that whole thing? And such bunk, such utter bunk. And so I slowly got into it. And one more thing I'll tell you, and then I think it'll be Billy's turn.
Right.
What I used to do is I would do things like Ernest Hemingway and Somerset Maugham used to do. I would hold parties and invite military people to come in with Wobblies, and my upstairs neighbor in Chicago, in Evanston, he and his wife were both communists, and I'd invite them. So I'd invite all these people, and then we had alcohol there, and they would, you know, drink and buy whatever and argue about Vietnam. And I found that was a way for me to kind of watch, let's you and him play, or in this case, let's you and him fight.
Brawl, perhaps?
Well, there was no brawl.
That's
there
good.
Were no brawls because I didn't get into VFP, Veterans for Peace, until 2003. And that's another story.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Bill, tell us about your service and then when you decided that it was the wrong conflict and you wanted to protest it.
Actually, I protested and thought it was the wrong contest to begin with before the service. I just didn't have the background or education, because being generous to Michael, I'm a little more than 10 years behind him. So when I hitchhiked out of Alaska in early 67 to go to California with a friend, because we wanted to go to San Francisco and be hippies and protest the war, and we didn't quite know enough to know by not finishing school that the people we were with were the movers and shakers that met people in the SDS and the Black Panthers and different groups, and we went to the protest. But it was at 17, we weren't as well educated. We just knew the war was wrong. We were against the war, but Mainly we were there to meet girls and find pot.
By the way, this is absolutely true. There is that no truer words have been spoken.
So on the fringes, not knowing that the people I should have really been at their knee learning was I was not aware enough of what it was, but I knew the war, and I didn't have the wherewithal to go to Canada. By the time I got in trouble and was looking at number one in the draft, then I decided, okay, I am either going to go to jail right now or join up, and deluding myself into thinking you could go into that size of a machine and make a difference from the inside, like the old musical hair, was 100% delusional. So we've already touched on a whole bunch of things that are separate shows, you know, that the history of Vietnam, the Ken Burns Novick mm-hmm. story is, you said exhaustive, I would say it just barely touched the surface. It did not cover even a beginning of what's going on. There's no reparations, there's no justice afterward. There are hundreds of wonderful critiques written about it in Vietnam and Southeast Asia papers about what is left out of that series. It's very superficial. And I would encourage anybody to look much deeper for what is not there.
Well, and let's take a call and get someone in Sitka in the mix here. Marion is in Sitka and a Berkeley organizer. Hi, Marion.
Hi. I was a low-level organizer in Berkeley during the anti-war time, and there are a few observations that I have looking back on it now. One thing that I want to emphasize is that we didn't see, we weren't anti-soldier. We worked with the Vietnam vets against the war and a whole lot of different groups. My level was more, you know, handing out pamphlets, talking to people, definitely going to marches and other types of protests. But the thing that I wanted to convey was this incredible sense of positive energy, and that there were so many of us who were really doing what we could to change the country to be peaceful and also to be a place where there was equality for all. And there was this tremendous feeling that I've never felt anything else like that. But we were really naive, and so it never... You know, your question at the beginning about where did this lead, I think it was a factor probably in ending that war, but it didn't lead to the kinds of things that we were hoping that it would lead to. But I actually think what happened is after the Vietnam War, conscription ended, and then the slow militarization of our culture, so that now, you know, we're in wars all over the place, and if you're not... I guess the other thing I wanted to say was the people that I knew, it was a big struggle for men who had a low draft number and were looking at going or not going, and what did it mean to be patriotic? And I think that patriotism is really thinking about your country and not necessarily supporting your government 100% or 10%, but making your voices heard. That's the only way a democracy works.
Yes.
I think that was a time when that was really powerful.
Well, thank you so much, Marion, for the call and your comments. I wanted to, and I'm going to start with you, Bill. The organization Veterans for Peace, there's a publication that I was reading about the spring publication talking about the full disclosure campaign.
Yes.
Regarding the Vietnam War, claiming that the DOD, the Department of Defense, is trying to whitewash the history of it. Tell us about this campaign, this full disclosure campaign.
Well, it's the basis of the organization of Veterans for Peace is to get the public aware of what the true cost of war is, that our every problem in the country can be solved by getting this information out, which is what essentially the protest of the 60s was against the war. We did stop that war. The people in the war, like Marion says, it was the millions of people who came out who didn't have a specific answer. But what they did know is, just like today, we know it is wrong. Just like during Iraq, we knew it was wrong. but we didn't turn out the millions of protesters on the street to force the truth to come out so they could, by overriding the media, could cover it up and persist with the money-making war. But the Veterans for Peace organization was ones that were persistent. So now our board, the advisory board on there is tremendous. Everyone from Yoko Ono to Bono to
Noam Chomsky
was on there. Just, it's a tremendous board now of getting out what is the awareness. And right now, the cost of war in 2005, worldwide, the gross national product of every country in the world went over 50%. We spend over half of every dollar in the world blowing each other up, mostly to the benefit of 12 major military contractors, who are usually U.S., but not all of them. And there's no problem in the world we couldn't solve with getting this information out. John Spitzberg has information on how you can get bundles of that full disclosure and spread that paper around and see what the true cost of war does to this country, every war, which we've been in constantly.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We're discussing protesting the Vietnam War. And we've got guests in the studio, Michael Carey, John Spitzberg, and Bill Barty. Michael is a journalist and a former protester. John and Bill are both veterans and also members of Veterans for Peace. One of the things in this write-up I read was Army veteran Doug Rollins talking about how the DOD set out to purposely mislead young people and considered a campaign of saying, well, the reason we lost the war was because the journalists did a bad job and misled the public, and that's why, and then they decided to abandon that. That's according to this write-up. Michael, from your experience as a news producer and consumer, how has the public sentiment toward the U.S. military involvement in war sort of ebbed and flowed through the decades, and how would you characterize the coverage that happened of the Vietnam War?
Well, I do want to address that, but before that, I was going to go back to something I think would be helpful, that Todd Gitlin, the professor at Columbia and student activist and was in many, many demonstrations, wrote that I think is really good, and it goes in part to Marion's comment. Millions took part in the demonstration, or again, in the anti-war movement, but mostly in low-cost, low-risk ways that comported with their personal style and their commitment to normal life. They signed petitions. They wrote to Congress. They wrote checks. They wrote poems. They wrote essays. They wrote letters to the editor. They attended anti-war poetry readings. They marched now and again, especially if a friend, someone respected, came along. They caused unpleasantness or screaming fights at Thanksgiving dinner. That gives you a sense of the breadth of the movement.
Sure.
The reporting, it is still argued. There are those people who definitely feel that the reporters, Neil Sheehan of the New York Times and others, are the source of why we gave up on the war. That many of the demonstrators would argue that that coverage at sometimes emphasized sort of the worst dressed, worst behaving, most whacked out, drugged up counterculture people. So people definitely will come to that with a different point of view. I think it's also important, one other thing, the Vietnam War went on for so many years that not only did the war take different forms, the protests against it took different forms. And there was a period that I don't think anybody who's in the anti-war movement is very happy about, the Weathermen period, when it became violent. And to my judgment, that was criminal, not protest.
And I do want to talk about some of that. Let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Douglas is in Anchorage. Hi, Douglas.
Yeah, good morning. Great discussion. I enjoyed Marion's comment, the theme about what is patriotism, and it's not blind obedience. I missed the Vietnam War draft age by about 3 years growing up in New York, and I distinctly remember the slogans, America, love it or leave it, and things like that. I distinctly remember when there was a protest, I believe it was at New York City Hall, and the construction workers came down and broke heads. And then later, at the Democratic National Convention, likewise a protest in Chicago, and heads were broken. And somehow in my adolescent mind, I was 9 or 10 at the time, I justified that that's what liberty was and that these malcontents were getting what they deserved. I'm the son of a World War II veteran, and I grew up with that mystique of we fight our enemies and we must be right. I went on to serve a military career 30 years, including a year in Iraq and a year in Afghanistan, and I'm pleased to say that I came to learn that, like Crispus Attucks at the Boston Massacre, liberty and patriotism is identifying when one's government is wrong and doing the wrong thing and speaking out. Mm-hmm. Dr. King had it right, Gandhi had it right, that peaceful protest would ultimately win. And so I had a major change of thought, notwithstanding my great upbringing and respect to my parents, but I came to learn that our government was lying to us, as it often does, to justify its means when it comes to the profession of arms, managing violence. And quite a history Ken Burns put together. I watched all the episodes. And as a result of our military, we can have this discussion today. Mm-hmm. Identify when our government is wrong and do so without fear of direct and formal retribution and punishment from our government. But I will say that while I am proud of my military service, I served 30 years, I also recognize that the men and women who protested when our government lied to us, from the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution all the way through, I've read all of the Pentagon papers, and it is our duty to speak up, though peacefully, when in fact our government is wrong. And some of these protesters got it right, others probably did not, but in the main, our government was lying to us, as I think the Ken Burns documentary showed from as early as 1962-63. Thank you.
Thank you, Douglas, very much. We're going to take a break in just a minute, but go ahead and add something.
I was just going to say that Howard Zinn wrote a book called The People's History of the United States, which I happen to believe that he portrayed, he stated very vividly in that book the concerns that many, many people had about the honesty, the integrity of those in leadership during Vietnam, and it's true today, and the other book is by Kusnick and Oliver
Stone.
By Stone, and they've written a history book about the very same thing. And I think that, by the way, I worked with emotionally disturbed kids. I was a special ed teacher. And the only book that resonated with the kids was The People's History of the United States. And I actually have a quote where a kid actually said, "This is the only book that makes sense to me because it's talking about me." So I want to end on that, about that. But if for any teachers out there, well, you're probably in the classroom not listening to this, but those two books are valuable books because kids resonate because they are there and mm-hmm. they know what they've lived.
We are going to take a quick break. This is Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the protests that surrounded the Vietnam War. And we've got two veterans who are also members of Veterans for Peace in the studio with us, and Michael Carey, longtime journalist. And we will take your calls and comments when we come back as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing protesting the Vietnam War and that entire era. From the perspective of all of you, let's talk a little bit about the demographics. Michael, you were going to lead into those bigger protests, let's talk about who these people were were at the front lines of the protests.
Okay, I have a good story about that. I was going to college in Ithaca, New York at Ithaca College in the 60s. And Cornell is a much bigger institution, much more, much older, much larger. And they started having, in the spring of 1965, teach-ins in which professors and others would start meet with students and talk about Vietnam. Mm. And I saw a poster for one of those, and I went to the Cornell campus. It was on some Saturday in the spring. This is the way I remember it. And a professor, George McTernan, K-N-K-H-I-N, gave a presentation. Apparently there were some people, some of these turnout at some of these teach-ins got into the thousands. I remember it as being much smaller. And then there was an ex-CIA officer who got up. He'd been in Vietnam for 3 or 4 years in the earlier stages of the war and just said, the war can't be won the way we're fighting it. And he thought that we would continue until we were forced to essentially leave. And I thought, wow, this is coming from somebody who's been over there. Then in 1967, there was a gigantic spring mobilization in April involving tens of thousands of people in New York City. And three things stood out. They were very well organized. There was a meeting the night before to tell us they were broken down into groups. What we'd be doing the next day, where we'd be doing it, and there was a high sense of organization and discipline. It took a lot of that. And then finally, there was an event where some protesters burned their draft cards at Central Park, and I think I remember this correctly, a Green Beret or former Green Beret in uniform burned some of his military documents. And this was just incredibly, you couldn't take your eyes off it. Then we marched through the streets of New York City with these huge crowds of protesters and people who were watching it. And the protesters were formed up in groups. Some were professions, by the professions. There'd be a doctor's group, a teacher's group. Some by universities. I wasn't. I was just in a student group. There were some by location, Chicago or Cleveland, for example. Some by affiliation, the Young Democrats, for example. There were lots and there were many, many young people in these tens of thousands of people, but also lots of older people, people even in suits. Speaking of suits, one of the moments that's most vivid to my comrades and I, as we were walking down the streets of New York City, there was a young woman who had a child who was next to me, and a man in a suit who was a counter-demonstrator was infuriated by her and screamed at her, "Lady, your kid's hopped up on LSD." And this became the joke for the rest of the parade of, where did he get the phrase, hopped up on LSD?
Wow.
The protesters or the people who were against the war would surprise you. One of my friends tells a wonderful story about he was going to come down from the University of Massachusetts to a big demo in Washington. And in the morning, he was getting his car ready to go, and he and his friends were standing out in front. And this older man who had a flinty New England appearance they knew around town as looking like a Calvin Coolidge Republican came up to them and said, "You going to that big demonstration in Washington?" They said, "Yes." The older man said, "In that case," and reached in his pocket and said, "Here's $5 worth of gas money. And when you get to Washington, kick Richard Nixon in the butt." I want to add one other thing, though, very quickly, and that is those protesters who went down the streets of New York City, some of them wound up serving in Vietnam after even being in that protest. I know that personally from people I know.
Well, it's similar to Bill's story about going to protest and then ending up in the service and thinking that maybe there would be a possibility of change from within. That's admirable, and I can see why a young person would think that way.
And how vulnerable they are even today that it happens again and again, Iraq, Afghanistan, that young people go in. And I ended up, frankly, to be very gung-ho and a Green Beret when the Green Berets were the only ones wearing that. Mm. Now every unit has a beret. So I really, even though there were a lot of conflicts with what we were doing, our units were mainly to not make contact, to win over the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people. That was the idea of the Green Beret and the advisors. And we had enough blacks in our units that it was way early before Black Lives Matter that we realized out in the field and out in the war, and I have several wounded friends that have been on this radio before that will tell you when you're getting shot up, you have their back and you count on them to have your back. And that was the end of racism.
Skin
until they got back to
then.
This country, and then after World War II, we found out it was just as institutionalized, and that even in Alaska, the blacks weren't allowed the Homestead Act and everything else for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues was the My Lai massacre, which in truth that Burns doesn't cover, happened 1,000 times. There were hundreds and hundreds of those massacres over there. Personally, my bubble was not popped until I was in Cambodia, where Special Forces picked up troops. We'd fly them into Vietnam, arm them, put them back into there, while at the meantime we were dropping more munitions on Laos than were dropped in the entire World War II European theater on one little tiny primitive country that we are still, through agencies in Hanoi and friends there, working with unexploded ordnance and Agent Orange and these things that are not covered appropriately in this documentary. And the My Lai was just one of them. That led George Miza, one of the protesters on the steps that was fasting on the steps of the Capitol, when they were throwing medals back over the fence. These were people who went to war, who were wounded, who came back and tried to tell the truth, and they were ostracized. So that's what started the real protest movement of the soldiers bringing out and doing the duty that the reporters, even though the reporters over there knew of it, they weren't allowed because of their publications or their news media to put it all out. But compared to today, they did a tremendous story. There were coffins, there were death, there was destruction. Today, the general public does not see that, does not have a vested interest in the wars we're in constantly all over the world. So there were some other points.
Over 200, am I right, Bill? It's over 200 places where we have military station in this world right now. Over 200.
Bases. Not just where we have them stationed. Yeah. At the time of the Vietnam War, we had a Special Forces A team in every country in the world.
In every country.
At least one 12-man team, including Russia and China and everywhere. Most of them undercover. But
yeah, right.
So to get sent to Vietnam was kind of a no way out of it. But the point I started at was while in Cambodia, my bubble was popped when I was reading in the American Times newspaper, the U.S. publication, how Nixon was standing before the public swearing we had no troops in Cambodia, and I'm reading it in the paper in Phnom Penh. I said, okay, maybe these liars are as bad as everybody says.
So. Yeah.
We're talking about protesting the Vietnam War, and we've got two veterans and a journalist, former protester in the studio with us. We're going to go back to the phones for a moment. Bill is in Kenai. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, great conversation. I'm glad to hear this stuff being talked about, especially in light of the fact that most of those participating in wars now weren't even around back then. I mean, it's been 47 years since I got my draft number huddled around a transistor radio in Kenai here at the cannery with six other guys trying to figure out whether, you know, what number you were going to get and what you were going to do about it. A bunch of us were going to Canada. I lived in Seattle at the time, was my third season in Alaska working up here. Loved it so much I ended up coming back, and I've been here for over 40 years. But, you know, my point is, people talk about, well, the one guy made the comment about girls and pot down in San Francisco. There was a whole bunch of stuff going on back then, and all us young folk were being educated. And a lot of us were naive. You never thought about a cop that might want to better his career by dealing you a foul hand, a priest that might abuse you, or a government that would lie to you. But we learned that those were the case, those were the things, and it opened our eyes. And you know, I didn't serve, but I got number 324. That was in 1970, so it was kind of the later end anyway. I participated in a couple of demonstrations at UW. You know, I went to the airports back then. You got McCord down at Tacoma, SeaTac, picking people up, seeing guys coming back, soldiers coming back, filling the airport up. I never for one moment thought of spitting on any of them or holding them accountable. I mean, at least I had at that young age that much awareness and stuff. But, you know, I think one of the things that I learned from all of that was not having been in the military, not having had any family members that were in Vietnam, how much it affected me, how much it affected me growing up and having at that young age this awareness and stuff about people that my age going over there and killing people because, what, they're communists, got different eyes and different skin color, and then finding out the government lied about the whole thing.
Well, thank you.
Glad to hear the conversation.
Thank you so much, Bill. And Bill Barty, you wanted to respond to that.
Just a quick interruption there that, yes, he is exactly right. And you can't beat yourself up about having the luck of the draw. My younger brother, drew number one in that drawing, and he went down and joined the Guard, fortunately, the next day. But everybody, and this is a major point in my life, and I've lectured it since, everybody in America was a veteran of the Vietnam conflict.
Absolutely.
Whether you were in the service, whether you protested, whether you didn't, whether you worked on a Texas cattle farm, if you were alive at the time, you were paying for the war, you were participating in the war. Those protests here, as Michael said about what led to violence, was people who were so frustrated that peaceful protests were doing nothing, that it spread around the world. That's what gave us Bader-Meinhof in Germany and other violent protests everywhere else, and saying, if peace isn't going to do it, they're going to erupt and make it and take the war to the war makers. Okay, sorry.
And I do want to talk a little more about that, but first I want to get to this email question that we had come in from Joe. He says, please talk about Nixon's interference with Johnson's efforts to end the war with the Paris Peace Accords. My brother was killed in Vietnam after that. Who wants to take that
I don't know enough
discussion
about that.
Point? Michael?
I really know what an average informed person knows about it, that it was well established, and Ken Burns went out after this, that Richard Nixon, before he became president, instituted his own foreign policy and told the South Vietnamese leaders to hold off on a peace deal because they get a better offer from him if he was elected president. You can argue that the war went on for many years longer because as a result of that. I just want to say something about the idea that we're all Vietnam veterans. I think I would phrase that a little bit differently, that the men who were of my age and a little bit younger and a little bit older all had to make decisions about the Vietnam War. There were a few who were physically unfit in an obvious kind of way. I knew people like that. There were a few who got married very young. There were some who had criminal records. One of my friends had a juvenile delinquent record, which kept him out of the military. But and also, as it's been pointed out, there were 35,000 people were indicted for resistance to the draft. 1,000 were convicted, and several thousand were sent to prison. Something like 30,000 people fled to Canada and other countries. 80,000, perhaps from as many as 200,000. There's a huge confusion about this. Were deserters. Mm-hmm. So these were all people who made decisions about the Vietnam War. And my colleagues here in this panel, they had their decisions too, as I did.
Well, and you know, my first husband, when he was in high school and he got out of high school, had a very low draft number and decided, okay, I better just join where I want to be. And he joined the Navy. But when he got to Minneapolis to get on a bus to go to California to boot camp, he said a Marine recruiter walked down the line and said, 1, 2, 3, you're a Marine, 1, 2, 3, you're a Marine. And the people that had signed up for one branch were automatically put into another branch. And he said he was just in the right spot in the row. So he stayed in the Navy. But he said these other guys were saying, no, wait, I'm in the Navy. And they said, no, you're signed up. You're going where we tell you to go now. So even the people who made choices didn't always have the choice that they had originally made. John,
let me tell you a quickie story that will interest everyone, I think. I was living in Hanoi after the war. And there is a fellow by the name of Sewell Jones. Sewell Jones is the president of the Veterans for Peace Local 160, which is the Vietnam chapter. And Sewell and a whole bunch of folks, John Lancaster, et cetera, were sitting in what we call the R&R bar. And three men from the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and I think they were fairly high up in the hierarchy there, showed up, and their goal was to start a chapter of the Veterans of Foreign Wars in Vietnam. And so they were told, you need to speak with Sewell Jones and the rest of these people. And Sewell, by the way, was a Marine, right? And he was injured in the war, and John Lancaster was shot in the back, and so he's in a wheelchair. So they met. And I, because I was not a Vietnam War veteran, I decided I didn't want to be part of that, but I'll take pictures of it. So I stood up. These guys from the Veterans for Foreign Wars were there to have a chapter to let the Vietnamese know that America was there doing the right thing in the war, and that the notion was we stopped. Even though we left in 75, I believe it was, that we stopped communism and the domino theory. And Sewell and John from his wheelchair, as I remember, and others became so frustrated. I don't think the Veterans for Peace had been born yet. So I don't know if they were peaceful or not. But all I know is these three men were escorted politely out of the building and had to go home back to Kansas. So that's an example of protest.
Let me go to the phones again for just a moment before we take another short break. Mike in Anchorage, hi.
Hey, I'm a disabled Army vet, and I'd just like to say that, make a quick comment that, you know, that the whole Vietnam era, people, I'm 58, people that are younger than me don't remember it. And it really shaped my childhood growing up. My father, who's a World War II vet, said, I'm going to Canada. He said, I'm not allowing you to go to Vietnam. And apparently Kennedy wasn't a big fan of Vietnam and actually wanted to pull us out there anyway. The other quick comment I wanted to make, and I don't know, I tuned in a little bit into the conversation, was the people that were friendly to us in Vietnam, apparently from Vietnam veterans, would become our enemy at night, would become Viet Cong at night. I got that from two separate sources from Vietnam veterans. So, you know, it was a really messed up war. Maybe they want to comment on the Viet Cong and how the people turned on us at night that were supposed to be our friends during the day.
Well, thank you, Mike, for the call. We'll get those responses after we take just a quick break, and Talk of Alaska will then continue statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Would you like to play an integral part to what you're listening to? Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, we thank you. If you'd like to become a member or sponsor, it's really easy. Start with a call to this station or visit us at our website.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We just heard from a veteran, and Bill Barty, you wanted to respond to his comments.
Yes. Actually, in a couple of days, I'll have a visit from my brother-in-law coming up from Canada, and he's one who went to Canada and didn't need to, being a full-blown diabetic, but because his friends were going, he went with them. And as they came back from after amnesty, he stayed and has a wonderful homestead down there. And just cost him several thousand to renounce his citizenship after our last war, because we were still taxing people overseas for war taxes. But the point was I wanted to address was about the Nixon question. And yes, he did manipulate that election, but it's not uncommon out of D.C. for that to happen. I mean, Bush did it with the Iran-Contra and keeping the prisoners in Iran, so that it would manipulate. We did it with the invasion in Iraq. The lies to get us into the war are overwhelming, whereas getting the truth out has to be millions of people to say, we don't have the details, but we know what it is that we need to get out in the streets everywhere. And that's going now. Right now, there is a new organization nationwide, which is... I'll come up with the name here in a minute, but there's a chapter in Anchorage, chapters all over it, and indivisibility, all eyes, indivisibility, and it's a chapter about getting the truth out in wars against the politics, against the fake news that is going on everywhere and nationwide.
Someone had sent in a comment about the alleging that Russia has been perpetrating propaganda as far back as the Vietnam War, and I don't have any way of confirming that, but this was a comment by someone who had called it.
I'm sure that's true.
Michael
they were
Carey.
Perpetrating various forms of propaganda. I just want to say a couple things in closing. One is to tell a little story. The British writer Edmund Blunden, B-L-U-N-D-E-N, was in the war, and like others, he wrote a memoir of the war, of his war experience. And there's a moment in there when this is 1918, the war is almost over, and a young soldier comes up to an older soldier, and the young soldier's only been in the trenches a few weeks. He doesn't know anything about the war except that it's been going on. So he says to the older man, "Who's winning?" And the older man says, "The war's winning." Mm. "The war's winning, and the war will keep on winning." Mm. Many years ago, my dad said, "We won't know what Vietnam did to us for 25 years. Well, he was wrong. It's something like 50 years later, and we still don't know what the Vietnam War did to us. Mm-hmm. The other thing I wanted to say is, Ken Burns and Novak used this very well, is John Kerry's testimony to Congress, where he said something that was true and probably unforgivable and may have cost him the presidency, when he sat before the Congress of the United States and says, "How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake?" And of course, Congress did what they do so well. They thanked him for his testimony and looked in the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
John Spitzberg.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you that there is something called the Drone Project.
Yes, please talk about that.
Let me just tell you that quilts, a couple of quilts that are that show pictures of people who have died and situations where people have died due to our drone warfare, which is illegal, internationally illegal, are coming to Alaska. They are being shipped as we speak this very day. And they will be here, and I live in Willow, so I'm going to get them up to Fairbanks first. We've arranged that they'll be in the library with documentation. The drone quilt, the quilt project, of course, is about what's going on in the here and now, not about Vietnam. But it is so very vital. He who does not learn from history is doomed to repeat it. I believe Santayana said that, and that is what's happening now. What these gentlemen have talked about, and others have talked about, is history. But if we don't learn from it, we will continue to make the same errors, and people will die, elders, children, workers. And I'd like to encourage people here in Alaska to seek me out through the channel, the radio station here, and we will get you the quilts so that your people, wherever you are, if you're interested, we'll see them.
The Drone Quilt Project.
Yeah, it's called the Drone Quilt Project, and it's put on by World Without War. Thank you.
Thank you, John Spitzberg. And finally, Bill Barty, closing.
Real quick closing, and thanks for the show. It's an end. You could do 100 on it. The upcoming November 11th is now Veterans. It was Armistice Day, and it was gradually morphed into a War Hero Day. But, it was about the end of war and peace. It was not about War Heroes, which is turned into now. And just in the last minute, I would say that all these disparate different groups and organizations and movements of resist and indivisibility and Black Lives Matter and Me Too and all these things are now coalescing as a group worldwide, not just in the U.S., but everywhere, to counter this fascist movement going on around the world. The people are saying we no longer need rulers. And I think that awareness with technology now, we're at the flux. Either it's going to be total fascist control, or the people are finally going to take charge and say we don't need rulers. And I believe we're real close to that.
Well, that is quite a way to end this program. Thank you so much to my guests, Bill Barty, John Spitzberg, and Michael Carey. We are going to do a two-hour special on veterans issues in November, in late November, as the Ken Burns, Lynn Novick documentary wraps up, and we'll be broadening it to more than just the Vietnam discussion, but we will be having a two-hour special toward the end of November on veterans issues and the current state of veterans today. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Raven Alaska, committed to customer safety and satisfaction, reminding Alaska that now is a great time to fly. Learn more at flyravn.com. GCI Business, with complete GCI data solutions for Alaska's most important organizations, GCI is your partner in possibilities.
And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, their financial investment and partnership with local companies at Point Thompson helps contribute to Alaska's economy and jobs for Alaskans. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we are grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.